Hello, welcome to the House of Commons. This is a regular podcast about politics. I'm Mark Thompson. I'm a political blogger and commentator. And every week we get a guest on from the world of politics and or journalism to discuss the two or three biggest political topics of the week. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Dan Snow, who is a broadcaster and historian. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Good to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. So the first thing, as we're obliged to do, certainly during the election campaign, or at least have been for the last few weeks, is we'll need to discuss the previous week's politics. And I mean, there's been a few things that have happened, but I guess the most significant thing will have been the question time debate that happened on Thursday. We're recording this on Sunday evening, so it's been a few days for it all to sink in. I mean, do you think that it was a significant political event?
Well, I think there's so many quite flatulent political events going on at the moment, whether it's sort of walkabouts in town centres or speeches in front of invited audience. I think it was a chance for people, normal actual human beings, normal actual voters, to give the politicians a good grilling. I mean, and they did get a good grilling, and I think it is fascinating. You know, one thing I noticed in studying, looking back over history, is that idea of deference. I mean, people are just so unimpressed by our political leaders. I don't think that's a bad thing, but I think that it's amazing, isn't it? They're happy to look them in the eye and really give them a good going over. I think it's great.
Yeah, I remember when I studied A-level politics, I kept on hearing this phrase over and over again: homogeneous and deferential, in terms of how the electorate, you know, generally treated politicians. And I suppose if you think back to like the Pathé newsreels of of the olden days, you know, with the minister, would you like to comment on this latest topic, or you know, what would you like to tell us? And it's just so far removed from that now. And go on.
Well, I think it's gone, and actually, it's a good thing. It's a good thing for loads of reasons. One, it's the 100th anniversary. You know, 100 years ago, we were fighting the First World War. Well, lots of deferential, but, you know, when you know, your Asquith and your Lloyd George told the lads to go and fight, they wouldn't fought. Well, I mean, thank goodness we don't live in that era anymore, because I think, actually, those kind of titanic wars don't happen if you just simply say, look, politicians, that you're talking balls, we're not going to do it. And that's, of course, that requires people on both sides to do that. But also, if you look at, frankly, the very depressing story of politics in America, which I and many always look towards with great passion and belief, you know, they in many ways did improve on British democracy, British constitution, when they set up on their own those centuries ago. But I mean, it's a shambles over there. You know, journalists standing up when the politicians enter the room, and you know, the president. I mean, it's embarrassing, frankly, the deference that goes on with politicians over there, and they actually all need a good kicking and a good bit of scrutiny.
So you prefer, I mean, actually, yeah, just in saying that, one thing that sticks in my mind was when George Galloway went over to America and faced the senators. And whatever you might think of Galloway, they just weren't expecting that, someone to just be that provocative and that unwilling to defer to the perceived authority.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And I don't think in the UK we understand. I mean, don't get me wrong, we've still got the mental deference thing going on with the royal family. So, but what happens in America, it's been elided in the form of their elected representatives. So they have a kind of semi, royal deference thing going on with people who actually work for them, you know, who actually who should be standing up when we enter the bloody room. You know, we're paying their salaries. So, and I think that's very depressing. I mean, I think it's appalling. So on the whole, I think it's good. On the other hand, it has gone too far, and in some ways, is that we all now just assume that politicians are kind of thieving lunatics and mendacious fools, and I kind of still want to believe they're not, although they continually let me down in that respect. But I do think we can. There is a danger, of course, of us all just going, they're all total idiots, they're not what they're doing, and they're all just on the nick and just useless people. And actually, that's not true either, and we probably should occasionally give them a little bit more respect than we do as well. So it's a very difficult one.
Yeah, and I have to say that audience didn't seem particularly willing to give the politicians credit for very much at all. I mean, they were very, in some ways, I was very disappointed that we have ended up not having a head-to-head debate that included, Cameron and Miliband, you know, in a kind of either one-on-one or maybe, you know, a three-way like we had last time, because I kind of felt in advance that we weren't going to get the level of scrutiny that I thought was appropriate. However, I have to say, against my expectations, the format of that question time episode with the audience doing the questions, and David Dimbleby basically just stood back and let them do it and didn't really interfere at all, apart from at one point, I think after a woman had asked a question three times and had kept coming back, in the end he basically told her to shut up. But apart from that, he just let them go, and they were pretty vituperative and really didn't let up, and we were calling them liars, and repeatedly questioners were insisting that the politician hadn't answered the question. And I know sometimes interviewers try and do that, but it tends to not gain that much traction. But when a member of the audience is saying, you haven't answered my question, that has quite a lot of purchase, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And I mean, I sometimes feel sorry for politics. I mean, who on earth want to be a politician? It's such a bizarre thing to do. And I mean, there's, you know, given that the age of deference has gone, and we, I mean, I can understand. If you're Winston Churchill, it must have been quite fun, you know, reviewing the fleet as it sort of anchored in Spithead, and there's, you know, hundreds of battleships, you know, in great time. It must have been quite a laugh. But I mean, now I just can't see what the perks of the job are, really. I mean, it's just a shambles. I suppose when they leave, they can make all sorts of money and do interesting things. But I mean, that's very sad in that case, if we say that being a politician is being reduced to like a CV building exercise when they leave, because it is quite thankless. I mean, I think the fact is, And it is hurt by our adversarial system. You know, the Tories are said by their opposition to be a bunch of Dickensian, psychotic, mill-owning lunatics. And Miliband is a bunch of written off by the Tories as kind of, you know, recidivist, Trotskyite, militant tendency people. And I think that actually, I think worryingly, that we don't listen to politicians. We are actually in ingesting that. And I think but what we're doing is we're taking both sides. So the people in that audience are saying Miliband's an incompetent, you know, lefty from the 1970s, and Cameron's a kind of wildly out of control toff who's literally trying to, you know, throw poor people out of their homes and make them feast on their own children. So, and actually both views are completely untrue. And I think both parties are propagating that, as you know, because actually they've got so much in common. They have to know, they're both broadly centrist, kind of Christian Democrat, mainstream European, you know, post-Thatcher, post-Blair politicians and parties. I mean, Miliband's definitely made some more noise that gets a bit further from that. But I mean, that's, and the trouble is that in order to attract voters, weirdly, your spin has actually got to be more extreme than the kind of reality is. And I think as an electorate, we've sort of ingested that. And I think we're overly negative about them all because we're buying into what they're telling us about each other, whereas in fact they're all, you know, kind of fairly. I mean, I look at that current crop of politicians, and in terms of their solutions to the greatest economic downturn, arguably in over 100 years, frankly, it was all pretty similar. They all kind of agreed, and they all wanted to crack on with it, but they didn't want to admit that, and so instead they just start hurling abuse at each other whilst quietly agreeing that. I mean, if you look at what Labour, I know people. The non-dom thing, I think, is a good thing, but Labour have announced some concrete policies that I think are a little bit further to the left than the centrist consensus. But on the whole, they've gone very quiet on welfare reform, and it's hard not to believe they're going to inherit most of Ian Duncan-Smith's stuff. They're going to keep. It's hard to see they're going to mess around with corporation tax or that kind of thing. It feels to me like the reason we're generating this kind of vituperativeness is because actually the parties want that to disguise the fact that actually they've got so much in common.
It's very interesting what you say, actually. I think I read some, I'm sure this isn't an original thought that sprung into my head. I must have read it somewhere. The way political debate happens these days, it's like the equivalent of McDonald's going around advertising that Burger King is going to poison you, and that Burger King turns around and says McDonald's hides razor blades in its food, and then both companies wondering why people stop buying burgers.
I think you've just said it much quicker and much more eloquently than I could. I think that's absolutely right. And actually, both burgers are bloody identical, you know, and that's the thing. And not, you know, but I think it's a sort of mutually assured destruction. Yeah. And I think that's what we've seen. And of course, the absolutely fascinating thing about this election, what I love about it, is that UKIP and the SNP have called their bluff. So in Scotland, the Labour Party have been shafted by spending years blaming Thatcher is red in tooth and claw for all of the problems of Scotland. And the SNP voters, all these Labour voters have gone to the SNP like, okay, well, you're right. I mean, we agree. So let's go. Okay, we're going to ditch you guys and we're going to go with a apparently more left-wing alternative. So, and I think the same is true of kind of UKIP, is that their bluff on both sides has been called, and both of them are absolutely hemorrhaging their right and left wing respectively to these new parties.
I mean, just before we move on to there's a particularly juicy topic I want to talk to you about and explain why in a minute. But just before we move on to that, we're in the last few days of the campaign now. Do you think anything significant is likely to happen in the next few days, or do you think we're just in the run-in now and really the course has been set and people will vote the way they've already pretty much decided? And also, bear in mind, I mean, there'll be people who voted by post. I've already voted by post.
I voted by post too. It's hard to say, isn't it? I mean, it's very hard to say. That is a question that you and I are uniquely badly placed to answer, because apparently most people think about politics for 4 minutes a week, right? I think about politics about 4 minutes out of every 4.5 minutes. So therefore, this campaign has had no effect on me particularly, because it hasn't increased my level of interaction with the political discourse. But however, maybe for people it does. So maybe the closer you get to polling day, the more column inches there are, the more social media there is, the more, TV there is. Maybe people do thought, right, crikey, I better make my bloody decision. And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, 92 looms large, doesn't it? I think 92 is an interesting one. Labour leads definitely narrowed. I mean, I know the Tory vote was shy, as they say in the polling jargon. Tory vote was a bit shy, but I seem to remember at the end, very in 92, and I was quite involved through my dad, we were all over all the polls every day. The polls did narrow a bit in the last few days, which did presage none of them predicted the Tory majority, but it presaged the fact that it could, a couple of percentage points off that notional Labour lead. So it wouldn't surprise me if things did change. We the polls are very interesting at the moment. There's this obviously debate this week about whether the internet polls different from the phone polls and stuff like that. And also, as the day gets closer, the people think more or less about the tax, the money in their pocket, or all these kind of issues. Or do you make lots of noise about the NHS, and then when the day of the election comes, they actually sod the NHS. It might be about who I trust not to raise taxes. I don't know. So who you and I think are probably not that well placed to answer that one.
Yeah, I think there is a little bit wood tree syndrome. I mean, but at this election campaign has nominally been going on for about 5 weeks, but really
Exactly.
it's been going on for about 5 years.
Of course,
and
yeah.
I've been as sucked into that as almost anyone in the Westminster Village, even though I'm technically not in the Westminster Village. I'm pretty obsessed with the subject, as it's pretty clear you are as well. So I think we are just going to have to wait and see. But I don't think there's any major set pieces over the next few days.
No, I can't see big set pieces happening. That's for sure. The polls suggest that if the Labour keep hammering on the NHS, and then the Conservatives keep hammering on the dangers of the SNP, both of which just totally mendacious arguments, but that's general elections, man. And you know what? You think people think this stuff is depressing, the world's going to hell in a basket. Let me tell you about elections past. I mean, we've seen it all before. And in fact, you have to be, you'd actually say that there's nothing unusual going on here at all. You choose an issue that you think you have a kind of zeitgeisty advantage over the opposition, even if it's completely not based in fact, then you just hammer the hell out of it, and after the election you stop talking about it altogether, and every government's done it, and they'll keep doing it, sadly, and think until we invent a new system.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the 92 election, and of course the one major campaigning point that sticks certainly in my mind about that one was the Tory Labour tax bombshell, where they had that massive poster of the bomb.
Yeah.
And actually, that was sort of Labour shot themselves in the foot, because what they did was they published a shadow budget before the election. It was John Smith who was shadow chancellor. And actually, all politicians have learned from that. I mean, certainly Ed Miliband, Ed Balls, David Cameron, George Osborne, they've all learned what you don't do is say in any real detail what you're going to do in terms of taxes and finances until after the election. And that's one of the reasons why during this election, there's this 8 billion or 12 billion hole in the Tories' plans for what they're going to do about benefits, and Labour haven't said what taxes they'll put up, and just because they've learned that if you do that you lose votes, and that's about
that's
as anti-democratic
important.
As you get, really, isn't it?
I think that's really important to point out, is that people complain about politicians. I actually believe you get the politicians you deserve, and the fact is you get the political discourse you deserve. If people are going to be swayed by poetic sounding appeals to I want to build a better Britain and believe in better, we can change, it's all good, vote in hope, then people get politicians who talk crap and then make decisions after they're in, and that's fine. If you're going to punish politicians in the past, politicians aren't stupid, they're humans, they're clever humans like the rest of us, and if they realize that by being honest about your plans and allowing people to quote excerpts and take things out of context and say, did you know they're going to do this, you shaft yourself. So in that case, walk around issuing platitudes, don't be honest with the electorate, because actually as an electorate, we aren't sophisticated enough to see to accept the fact that that newspapers and other people might spin a shadow budget, for example, in dodgy ways. And so, very depressingly, I think that is our responsibility. You know, it is our fault, basically, that politicians talk in sound bites. Because when they say longer, more sophisticated things, they get destroyed. And how many Twitter storms we had over the last year of a politician saying something unguarded, thoughtful, lengthy, that can be taken out of context, is a bit silly, a bit weird, a bit off the wall, and it absolutely annihilates their career. I mean, it's ridiculous. Why would you, as a politician, dare say anything? Why not just say in all your tweets, great days campaigning, walking the streets for a better Britain? You know, that's
what most of them do say these days, Dan.
No, but I don't blame them, because the trouble is, the minute they say other things, they're just, we the people, unfortunately, react to them so badly. And I think we have a huge debt of a burden of responsibility for that, the total lameness of our discourse.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. I did write a piece, I think it was a year or two ago, where I basically said I'm going to do something that most politicians don't do, but as I'm a politician, I'm able to, and that is blame the electorate. And I basically said the argument that you've said there, that we allow politicians to get away with this stuff, and we vote for the ones who are, who do obfuscate. And so they learn, it's like any kind of situation, and any good economist will tell you that people respond to incentives, and the politicians are just responding to the incentives that the electorate give them.
And on the kind of historic strategic level, as a democratic politician, why on earth would you pay down the deficit? I mean, I wouldn't. I mean, it's a joke. You know your career is going to last 10 years at best. Just chuck money at people. I mean, that is the million-dollar question about Western democracy, is can we cope with this problem that they are completely unincentivized to make sensible decisions? So do we... And they're saying, look, I would love to reduce the national debt, but my God, you are not going to get a vote for reducing the national debt. That's the problem. So the electorate, we the people, I'm a voter, I'm part of the electorate, we have to take responsibility for these Muppets who are our politicians, our leaders, and for the decisions they make.
Indeed. Okay. Let's move on to what I alluded to earlier on as the juicy topic, because regular listeners to this podcast will know that one of my major hobby horses is electoral reform. And I certainly couldn't allow having you on as a guest, Dan, to pass without talking about this subject, not least because you're an Electoral Reform Society ambassador, I believe. And I know it's a real passion of yours. I mean, we could just sit here and I could ask you what's your favourite electoral system and why should we change stuff, and that might not be too interesting because I suspect we'd agree quite a lot. What I'd like to maybe just discuss a little bit is whether you think we're likely to get electoral reform, perhaps not in the next few years, because we already had the AV referendum in 2011, so it's probably a little bit early for another referendum for Westminster, but the way politics is going now, and the way, certainly if the polls are correct, the electorate is starting to vote, we're already starting to see a real splintering of the vote, and the votes that the two main parties could count on, 95, 98% of the electorate voting for either blue or red, which we used to see in the 50s. I mean, that's been progressively decreasing to the point where it was 65% of the electorate voted for the two main parties last time. It's probably going to be around about the same this time, but you could certainly imagine by 2020 or 2025 that would be lower, perhaps much lower, depending on what happens. So given that we're already seeing that fragmentation, I mean, there seems to be evidence from abroad that changes in electoral systems tend to follow the polling trend. So the more fractured a political, an electorate becomes in terms of who they vote for, the more likely it is that you will get a more proportional system, just because it becomes absolutely preposterous to stick with first past the post. Do you think there actually is hope for us electoral reform?
I think it's inevitable. First of all, let's be clear. We've been changing our electoral system since 1832 regularly. We just happen to be going through a phase at the moment where we haven't changed it very much. We changed it in the early 1950s. We stopped university graduates being able to vote twice. We stopped business owners being allowed to vote in all seats. We've just had a few decades over the kind of historical long view. We've just had a few decades now where we haven't reformed it, but we have to reform it because it doesn't work anymore. And in fact, brilliantly, I say brilliantly, incredibly depressingly and shockingly, this electoral system we have now is quite literally destroying the very fabric of the country. I mean, you couldn't make it up. I mean, it's, for conservatives saying it's the safe, conservative and strong option, it is neither providing strong, stable government, nor, and in fact, what it is doing is accelerating the destruction of this country. SNP are on course to win maybe slightly under 50% of the vote in Scotland, and they are due to win nearly 100% of the seats in Scotland, massively exaggerating the effect of nationalism in Scotland on the minds of people in England and our fellow citizens across the UK. So it is absolutely, literally ripping the country apart, which is extraordinary, which is totally extraordinary. A voting system that is supposed to provide a kind of harmonious way for people to resolve differences and for our representatives to gather and seek the way of establishing a legitimate government that can enshrine the votes and best wishes of a majority of the population, if you like, is actually exaggerating difference in this country and ripping it apart. It is also, by the way, doing things like making people believe that their vote is not worth casting and therefore turnout is going down, and that's true. It isn't worth. It isn't where I live. I live in Hampshire. I have a choice at this election between voting for a person who has been the MP for decades, or a Liberal Democrat who is in the government with him. So I get choice. I basically can choose between whether I want two people in government. If I vote for Labour here, if I vote for the Greens, if I vote for anyone else, it is quite literally a wasted vote because they have absolutely no chance of getting in whatsoever. So that, therefore, I genuinely was wondering whether or not I should bother to vote. And luckily, I'm going to postal vote. If I had to be here on the day, I don't think I'd bother because it's a bit of a hassle. So, but it will change because it doesn't work. It doesn't do the job that it was assumed it would once do, which was provide strong, stable government. So I think it's inevitable change. I suspect we'll get a change without a referendum because I think we'll have a Royal Commission. All parties will agree that there's a clear and present danger to our country and our legitimate democratic government. And I suspect we will get, and the reason I think we'll get a change without a referendum is probably because we're already using different voting systems to vote in all sorts of other elections across the UK, whether it's Europe, the Mayor of London, the Scottish Parliament, all sorts of other elections. So there is already an established and legitimate alternative voting systems available in the UK. But no, we need a Royal Commission. It needs to have a long, it can't seem to privilege any party. It can come in 8 years, come in 10 years' time, whenever you want it to come in. I don't want it to be seen as a party political thing for short-term gain. But we have to change this system before it totally alienates more people from the... And, you see Sandy Toksvig starting a women's party. Everyone's going, that's great, a women's party. I mean, anyone with the faintest knowledge of our electoral system has to realise it's a total waste of time and money. Good luck to them. Brilliant. I've already liked them on Facebook. I'm happy to sign up and do whatever I can for them. They are not going to win it. It will take 30 years to win a seat, if that, and they're going to get wiped out time after time because our electoral system absolutely destroys minor parties unless they can form a regional power base in very unusual circumstances, like SNP have done and like UKIP are sort of trying to do at the moment. But I think it's absolutely inevitable.
Well, it's good to hear someone that positive and that enthusiastic about the likelihood of it happening. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm just a little bit more jaded because I can't help but feel that if the polls are right and what happens in the election. I mean, let's say, for example, the Tories get the most votes, but Labour get the most seats. That is quite a distinct possibility because of the way the boundaries are. I suspect that the Tories' reaction to that will not be, right, OK, the time has come for a Royal Commission. Let's look at some kind of proportional system. It will be to say the boundaries are wrong. The Lib Dems stitched us up. If the boundaries had been changed, it would have been fairer. Let's change the boundaries. I cannot see the Tories in any reasonable time frame from now, changing their spots on this. They are absolutely wedded to first past the post. As you rightly say, the electoral system has changed a number of times, and we did used to have single transferable vote in certain seats, and we did used to have university votes and all the rest of it. So it has changed, but that isn't the narrative that was spun during the AV campaign. First past the post was seen as this thing we've had since time immemorial. And it was the Tories that were largely pushing that, but there were a lot of reactionary elements in the Labour Party as well, which is why I've seen some articles in the last few days. I think there was one in The Independent, and also Mark Ferguson wrote on Labour List today that he and the person who wrote the other article, but I've seen a few others as well alluding to this, that it's very likely that if Ed Miliband gets in a minority government, that he will actually push for some kind of proportional system. I just can't see it. His party won't let him do it. No matter how sensible it is, there's just too many vested interests in the current system.
Except half the vested interests have just been literally wiped out in Scotland. So Labour now need proportionality in Scotland. They desperately need it. Luckily, the seismic votes flowing away from the big two parties, I think, has meant that they have to accept that there has to be some kind of proportionality. Because ultimately, what they also don't like total dysfunctionality. And it's very hard to see either side. I mean, interesting. I mean, either side polling enough to get a over 25 seat majority, which realistically is kind of, I mean, John Major won in 92, but had them. I mean, that was not a strong, stable government. I mean, that was a miserable experience for everyone involved, which John Major has spoken very openly about. So I think these changes are probably here to stay. I think people are probably less tribal in voting. You know, all the old reasons, people are happy to change. They change their jobs, they change their wife, they change their husband, they change their, you know, sexual orientation more these days. I think people are going to change who they vote for. And I encourage that. That's extraordinary to me when I see it, you know, someone goes, well, I'm a lifelong, you know, Tory voter. I go, well, that's absolutely absurd. I mean, the way to hold a party to account, the way to hold politicians is to threaten to withhold your vote. It's completely deranged to... I mean, there are all these people who merrily voted for Tony Blair, and then Tony Blair raided Iraq, and they merrily voted for him the next time. I mean, it's bizarre. Quite rightly, lots of people are changing the way they vote, and I encourage that. But let's build a system where that is actually... I mean, what I think is really interesting is we're going to be told on Thursday by the big two parties that what's dysfunctional, you're right, it's either boundary change, or somehow that we, the people, have made a mistake. You know, we've screwed up. We voted for the wrong people. We've created this coalition of chaos. We haven't screwed up. There's all sorts of voting systems around the world that could create an executive branch that is stable and solid. We could have a runoff system. We could actually, crazy thought, we could actually vote for our executive. All these Milibands and Camerons running around the place, none of us can actually vote for them unless we happen to live in their constituency. I'm quite a weird electoral reformer. I'd like to see the legislature and the executive divided up. I'd like to see a vote for someone to be in charge. So and every single vote in the country counts, which at the moment it doesn't. And like it did in Scotland, you either vote yes or no, and you vote for the person you want to see in charge. You have a runoff, so the top two people go through. You can then vote. So everyone has had a chance to vote for and against somebody who will become prime minister, call them. And then I'd like to see votes for the legislature as well, so you can actually send someone from your local area who can do some ass-kicking when he gets to Westminster or she gets to Westminster and actually sort out the executive branch. That's how things are meant to work. So, I mean, we're going to be told it's our fault that it's dysfunctional. It's not. It's the voting system's fault. We're allowed to vote whoever we like. And I would actually, I encourage people. I think it's brilliant that people are voting for the Greens. I don't like the SNP at all, but I think it's encouraging that places need to be shaken up. Parties need to be shaken up. And lots of their heartland leaving in droves is exactly what they need.
I mean, one thing that I fear may happen, and you made reference to this a little bit earlier on, is that the lesson that parties will learn from this election is that you have to concentrate your vote, that's the way that you're going to game the system, game the first past the post system. And the SNP look like they're going to do that brilliantly. And you've only got to look, they'll get about 4% of the vote, but they could end up with around about 8 or 9% of the seats. Whereas UKIP could easily get 10 or 12 or even 15% of the vote, and they'll be lucky to get 0.2% of the seats or 0.3% of the seats. And that's absolutely ridiculous. But I wonder if what may happen is that we may start to see parties like, say, Mebion Curnow down in Cornwall. Maybe we might start to see parties, say, in Yorkshire. I mean, Yorkshire has a very, very strong regional identity. Maybe we'll start to see parties spring up there who will say, well, you know, we want a bit of this pork barrel action that the SNP are getting. So, you know, we're going to push forward like a Yorkshire First party.
Yep. Yeah.
They could start to get some seats. If they hold the balance of power, suddenly Yorkshire's getting all of the, you know, all of the gravy. That would be crazy. And I suspect were that to happen, or were that to start to happen, then actually there would be reform, because it would be admitted by all concerned that the game was up. But I fear we may have to go through a few more cycles of this before
they agree.
Yeah,
we may have
agree.
To go a bit further. But I mean, it doesn't work. And the best thing is it does not work, right? So for 100 years from 1915 back to 1915 to now, we've had 100 years, and for precisely one third of that time, 33 years, we have had we have not had strong single party rule. We have had minority or weak coalition government rule, or very, very thin majorities, like, you know, John Major's in 92. So we have not, the system has not delivered what it was supposed to have delivered, and that appears to be getting worse. We'll have had that, you know, assuming we're going to have that this time, we'll have had that, you know, going forward now. So it'll be 10 years from 2010 onwards. So it luckily that the system itself will collapse under its own strain. But it's annoying that as it goes down, it's going to virtually take the entire country with it, whereas it could be changed with a swish of a pen.
Hmm. I wrote a piece a few weeks ago. I said, why do we always have to reform our politics the hard way? Why do we always have to wait until it's at breaking point before we do something about it? But that's probably in the nature of human beings and probably in the nature of systems, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's depressing. I mean, what you have to hope is that they don't just thrash it out over some late night coalition agreement. Actually, let's just have a royal commission.
Yeah.
And well, we all know what we want to end up with, which is multi-party, multi-members STV seats. But I mean, it's extraordinary we have to spend so much time getting there. I mean, I do think the Tories, I mean, they are like turkeys voting for Christmas. I mean, they would probably, I mean, I don't know, you've probably crunched the numbers and seen the numbers. They'd surely would be on course to win a majority now if they had, even if they'd said yes to AV. I mean, it's bizarre. The Tories are going to lose this election because they said no to AV. The Liberal Democrats are going to survive because AV didn't get through. I mean, it's completely remarkable.
Yes, it is indeed. There's not many things that are actually genuinely ironic, but both of those things are.
Yeah, no, it is genuinely ironic, this election, for when you look back at that AV referendum campaign. It's absolutely fascinating.
All right, great stuff. Well, thanks very much for your time today, Dan. Very much appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And I just so your listeners know, on election night, I'm
Yeah.
going to be running an alternative election night broadcast called The Unelection.
Yeah.
So look out for that on Twitter and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll hope to pop up as a guest on that at some
Oh, yeah,
point.
brilliant. Please do.
Good stuff. All right. Thanks, Dan.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Cheers. And I'd just like to thank Audio Boom, who very kindly hosts the podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back soon.